Myth, episode 487 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I'm not ready to call it yet, but I think Kirk Acevedo may be becoming the new Sean Bean.
And this is Gary from Jacksonville, and oh no, these things on my wrists, they really heal well. Don't worry about me, I'm fine.
Yeah, and we are going to, well, let me ask this, let me ask Simmons, she's right here, what are we going to... Oh, okay. Yeah, so we're going to go ahead and do like we normally would do and talk about some episodes this time around. But before we do much more of that, Edmund, if you could please.
Absolutely. We do not like to be restricted in any way about what we talk about or who we talk about it to. So if you haven't seen any of these, you will be absolutely horribly spoiled. We always try and wait a week or so before we do that horrible thing to you.
That's right. That's right. And well, Gary, why don't you go ahead and choose our first topic?
Actually, John, just real quick before we start discussing the shows, I just wanted to give a news update on something I'd mentioned the last episode. There was talk about Shatner being in the next Star Trek movie, and he replied that he has not spoken to anybody. Well, in the short time since we taped our last show, he has been in touch with J.J. Abrams, and it's starting to look more promising. So, yeah. Anyway, I was excited as a big Star Trek fan. I was really, you know, hopping up and down. It'd be really nice to see, you know, Kirk, heck, it'd be nice to see the whole original crew in their uniforms, especially as the 50th anniversary hits in 2016. So maybe they can get even more people. But how are they going to pull that off? It'd be ridiculous, but I can still hope. Anyway.
It couldn't be any less ridiculous than Red Matter.
Yes.
Anyway, and I say that as a fan of the movie. All right, Gary.
Yes.
What shall we talk about first?
Well... Let's see. We have so much to talk about tonight, but let's start off with both of our intros, since we're of course more important than anyone else, and go right over to S.H.I.E.L.D.
Sounds good to me. And here's the promo.
What once was S.H.I.E.L.D. no longer exists, but their enemies are still out there, and the world can't save itself.
This is a make-or-break moment. I'm going to finish what I started.
Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Season premiere Tuesday, September 23rd at a new time, 9, 8 Central on ABC.
And if you could begin, please.
Absolutely. We're talking about S.H.I.E.L.D. Season 2, Episode 1, Shadows. In the Season 2 premiere, Coulson settles into his new role as head of S.H.I.E.L.D. as his team expands to take on new and different threats.
Okay, and what would you give this one?
Well, geez, it did have Dum Dum Dugan in it, and that alone deserves an extra point on anything. I will give it a 9.
All right, Edmund, how about you?
I'll go 9 as well.
All right, and I went with an 8.5, so not that far off. And while we are talking here, I will also check with our friends over at Vogue, because I did not see any earlier this week, but I may have missed something over the weekend while I was away. But in the meantime, all right, we've got an average so far of just under 9. That's huge. What? Get me started here, Gary. What was your highlight other than Dum Dum Dugan, of course?
Well, that goes without saying. Good right. Old Timothy Dugan. Anyway, I don't want to jump through, but my best point for this episode was when Sky was talking to.
Dalton?
Yeah,
I think that's Ward. The name of the actor.
Yes.
Ward was talking to Ward when he was in the jail cell, and she was like looking at him, and she saw the scars on his wrists as well as the scars on his face, because not only did he try to kill himself by cutting his wrists, but I guess he tried to, you know, bang his own head in. And, you know, you had this sense of this just completely broken man. And, you know, he had been so defiant and strong and steadfast and, you know, so gung-ho that, you know, I don't know if this is another ploy on his half, but, geez, to put himself through all that physical mutilation and try to kill himself before they patched him back together, I think was his exact words, that, geez, I could only help feel pity for the man that helped, you know, overthrow S.H.I.E.L.D. But, you know, it was such a sad place to come through. I'm not saying I forgave him, but I did feel bad for him. And, you know, that, you know, as he was, you know, talking to Sky and saying, you know, but it's all okay. I just want to help you. I just thought it was a really great little, you know, vignette that, you know, or a little monologue that he was giving during the course of that little interaction.
Yeah, I mean, that was probably one of the best parts of this episode. I guess the only thing that I didn't quite enjoy about that, that was the fact that it still seems as though Ward is a little bit hung up on Skye, and I never really liked that whole love undercurrent between the two of them, because it kind of happened quickly and wasn't entirely convincing.
Well, it doesn't seem like it's between the two of them anymore.
Yeah, exactly. But maybe that's just part of his general insanity, shall we say.
Yeah.
That's very possible. Now, the second highlight for me was the integration of the whole Carter sequence back with that, with the, what I think, SSR-084, the box.
Yes.
I realized that it's not quite a backdoor pilot, because it was such a small amount of time in the episode, but I thought they did a very good job of integrating it and showing what, you know, it was relevant for them to have the flashback and show her capturing the device.
Yes.
It wasn't just, you know, thrown in there for like a sneak preview of what it's going to be.
Yeah, it was a nice double usage of that footage, because, again, yeah, it was a nice preview for Agent Carter, but it also was giving you the opportunity to come into the new season with a bit more action, I guess you could say. Edmund, what do you think of either one of those?
I certainly thought the introduction of Agent Carter right up top was a nice use of bringing that storyline in and the characters in. Certainly, you know, for those who haven't seen the movie, it has been a while, or any of the web offerings. For me, I don't know if I'm just heartless, but I still see Ward as being completely manipulative with what he's doing. I mean, I think Brett Dalton's did a fabulous job acting it. I mean, that, you know, this is kind of what we've been saying ever since his reveal was all these people who were saying, oh, he's just so wooden, etc. And then he was just setting up the character, and that was certainly continuing. But my sense was, you know, yes, okay, so trying to commit suicide when you're in that sort of detention and under that sort of scrutiny is a situation where you can be pretty much sure that you're not going to succeed. So especially once they pulled the hole, she slams the virtual wall down just before he says, I'm about to tell you about your father. I mean, that for me almost clinched it, that, you know, no, this is still him trying to work his wiles. But I guess it may be partially my way of dealing with the fact that the romance and chemistry between them has always felt so forced. So if it's not really real, then, you know, then it's more palatable. But certainly for me, I mean, the other just whammo moment was that classic Whedon-esque reveal of Simmons not actually being there, and the fact that it had that all of those sequences were Fitz just imagining her there. I thought was beautifully set up. I mean, I really had no idea. I mean, I didn't, you know, it's one of those where I haven't had a chance yet, but I keep needing to go back to the episode to watch those earlier scenes just to pick up on how well they did that, because I really did not even suspect it. And then that just broke my heart when it was finally revealed.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that was a highlight, I think, for me, was just how well that was played out. How about you, Gary? What were your thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah, and it's interesting, because the way they had given teasers coming into this was, I had the sense that he was much more mentally handicapped than he turned out to be. So it sort of took me by surprise, the ending. You know, of course, Whedon manages to do that a lot for me. But, you know, I understood that, you know, they were talking about him having severe mental problems or things along those lines. So I expected him to, you know, be, you know, sort of almost Stephen Hawking's was my expectation. So when I first saw him up around and functioning and things like that, I sort of, oh, you know, whatever, they, you know, dismissed it or something like this. But no, as they, you know, when they hit that final scene, you start to realize how messed up he really is. So they sort of, you know, raised my hopes and then managed to crash them again.
Yeah, so I mean, talk about raising hopes and then crushing them. How about the introduction and possibly departure already of Lucy Lawless' character?
Oh, geez, why the heck put that much time into development for a character? You know, she had and just kill her like that. It doesn't make any sense. You know, they almost had a second team up and running, so to speak, and, you know, and they just shot it. It doesn't. I have no idea, unless she's a life model decoy, which I'm still waiting for them to show it. Good gosh, don't they tease us enough?
She could very well be at this point. Let's see, Edmund, how about you? What are your thoughts there? Is Lucy Lawless just a one-off character, or are they playing very, very coy here?
Yeah, no, I suspect they actually did go for the gutsy play, and especially as Gary said, between the way they were developing the character and certainly who was playing her, I think this is a instance of that them really wanting to ramp up the desperate situation they're in, that even as they're trying to expand their capabilities and bringing in people who they might not be that comfortable with, but have to rely on given the circumstances, and then to have that even that ripped away, I think could be the beginning of an arc of them really hitting bottom before they can start rebuilding.
Well, it makes sense that there would be losses along the way when they're trying to do this whole process of restoring S.H.I.E.L.D. and fighting Hydra, which is, as one would expect, all over the map.
Yes.
I mean, talk about the visual version of Cut Off One Head and Two More Appear.
Mm-hmm.
I think just that this did a great job of touching on all the characters. Maybe May was a little less covered than I would have preferred, but even that being said, I just think that there was a lot that was going on. It picked up right where it left off and did not give me any reason to think that they were going to regress back into the uncertainties of the first two-thirds of the first season. So
certainly
it sounds like you guys agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one thing you're mentioning in terms of, I mean, I think in terms of the quality and the direction of the show, they were picking up right where they left off. But one thing I found an interesting touch was the way they used Sky, both in terms of the new haircut, but also bringing her into that operation. Where they were obviously showing how much more capable she had become, and giving you that sense that no, there has been this period of time of certainly a number of months since we last saw them, and then confirmed when Ward was talking about how obviously May's been training her, so I thought that was a nice little touch just to let you know that some time has passed, and they're moving on as best they can, but no, we're not just picking up right where we ended last season.
And obviously there was a sense of time that went by from the end of the last season to where we picked it up this season, but at the same time it felt that they hadn't accomplished much. Coulson mentions he's taking flights all over the place to try and find allies, and they have to recruit basically mercenaries. I'm getting the sense that he's not having that much success finding allies, or there'd be a little bit more. They'd be a little stronger at this point. I think it's. They're implying it's been a very uphill battle that to try and recapture some S.H.I.E.L.D. tech that they have to actually go to where a bunch of it's locked down. I would think with bases literally all over the world that there would be an easier place than basically outside of D.C. and on an army base to try and recapture some of this stuff. But it seemed a little bit of a stretch that there wasn't a softer target to hit to get what they needed.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they are still not, even if they are not necessarily under the gun to the same degree that they were before, they're still considered to be persona non grata, and there is the whole Hydra thing out there still. So I don't know. We're going to have to see exactly how much they build on this beginning to really flesh that whole idea out. But at any rate, we've got a great start to this season. I mean, certainly it's a big jump over last season started, and I'm pretty happy with it. So that having been said, any last thoughts on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
I wish Coulson seemed more in control of the situation. He seems as flummoxed and lost as his entire team does. And I'm not saying he has to feel not be in control, but feel like he's got sort of a vision or some sort of plan, and it doesn't feel like it. Anytime Nick Fury would come up, even if he got surprised, he'd be sort of be on his feet and moving forward, and Coulson doesn't seem like he's there yet.
I wonder if that's supposed to be reflective of the fact that he maybe doesn't even really know who he is at this point. There are certain indications in the episode that he's still not sure what happened in terms of his resurrection. He's a little bit uncomfortable about that, but
I was under the impression that was all put to bed, honestly.
I'm not so sure.
Okay.
Well, I mean, there is the whole question of the strange symbols that he was producing, and of course, is having Sky still analyze the ones from Garrett. So, you know, yeah, there is still that lurking mystery over what exactly happened.
Hmm. There you go. All right. Well, I think we've wrapped up our discussion on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and that means that, Edmund, you get to make our next choice.
Okay. Let's move on to, the premiere from the night before, Sleepy Hollow.
Sounds good to me, and here's the promo.
They've been planning this since before the birth of our nation.
This is war.
I know this key. Benjamin Franklin. We must find him.
Are you sure you know where we're going?
Unquestionably.
Even a man from the 18th century won't ask for directions. This is insane.
War is hell.
All right, and if you could do the recap.
Certainly. Sleepy Hollow, Season 2, Episode 1, This is War. In the Season 2 premiere, Ichabod is buried alive in a coffin, Abby's in danger of spending an eternity in purgatory, Katrina is a reluctant guest of the Headless Horseman, Captain Irving is in jail on a murder charge, and Jenny is in a car accident.
So not a lot happened, is
no.
What you're trying to say.
Yeah, no, although I think that's more... supposed to end the premiere, that's more... This is where we left them at the end of last season.
Yeah, I guess that's one way of looking at it.
Yes.
Because certainly, as we know, this episode, well, it definitely made us a few statements. Yes. Gary, what would you give this one?
I would give it an 8.
All right. And Edmund, how about you?
I will go 8.5.
Okay. As did Henry in his review, and I would give it an 8. So there we are, fairly consistent look at this, coming in around 8.3, or 8.25, in fact. So that being the case, Edmund, you get us started here. What was your highlight for this episode, do you think?
I think one of the highlights was I've occasionally mentioned on here how it seems like any time people are doing fantasy sequences or dream sequences in the last few years that I can almost always pick it out almost immediately, and in this case it was a matter of. Even though off right at the top, I mean, just the way they set it up with the shift from him lying flat to the swinging the camera upright, I was pretty sure this was that whole opening sequence was some sort of ruse or fantasy. But it was just so entertaining and so well done that I just completely gave into it. I thought they actually did a very good job of it. I mean, where you were going all the way through until you saw just that little tree. Root effect on the desk, but also just getting to see Abby and Ichabod just kicking butt and taking on the horsemen and having cool bullets and crossbows was just a lot of fun and a heck of a way to kick off the season with everybody wondering, okay, how are they going to get out of this, and instead you get to see them having some great action, and then John Noble comes in to start establishing himself as our big bad villain for this season, so I thought it was just a really fun start.
Gary, how about you? I mean,
well,
you kind of summed it up very nicely, but how about you?
The opening parts. Yes, there are other things.
Edmund's very articulate, but let me try to add my two cents as well. I was afraid they were going to go Kill Bill when he was in the coffin for a few moments, but I thought that his little gunpowder solution was refreshingly different, and so I enjoyed that. The whole dream sequence thing, he's absolutely right. I didn't catch it either. It caught me off guard, and given the nature of this show, you know, it was perfectly believable that it could happen. It wasn't something that was slightly askew or so rosy or so horrible that you couldn't imagine it happening. So I think it's sort of quasi-basis in what could be reality helps sell the sequence for me. I love in general, I love the sense that the episode gave me of the tension ratcheting up, and you know how serious and dangerous things are getting. I really had that sort of, you know, sense of dread, which they sort of just built the whole episode for me. Even through the whole rather upbeat thing of them discovering the key first and stuff like that, but it still never sort of was the relief valve to, you know, let the tension off the episode. And then when the I don't know what we want to call him anymore, I'll say the Horseman of War, John Noble, again, he still keeps selling things extremely well for me. I mean, you know, he's just the way he's able to just, you know, push out this whole sense of evil, just pure evil, is quite a statement to his skills as an actor. But even the special effects I thought were pretty good. Moloch, I think it was Molik. The 3D effects for him were very, very good, and you know, it didn't take me out of the scene at all to see the special effects work. So I really liked it, and like I said, it kept it going, and I'm looking forward to the next few episodes to see if they can keep the pace up. Also, seeing the horseman's head all the time was a little disconcerting. I'm so used to him without the head. That while they save special effects money, I understand. At the same time, I've actually gotten used to him with just the big shoulders. So.
Yeah, although I was rather amused at them throwing in the hunky shirtless shot. You know, I don't know if they're feeling some competition from Outlander, where they think they need to cater to that side of the audience.
Of course they do. Come on, at this point it's fairly obvious that. Well, for me, I mean, just the fact that I was somewhat concerned that they would maybe dial back the insanity just a little bit because of the fact that the show turned out to be more popular than they had counted on. And I'm so glad they didn't.
Oh, no, they didn't.
This whole episode was just pure, unadulterated absurdity from start to finish, and I loved it. The only thing that held me back a little bit was that I feel like the whole Katrina thing still isn't quite working for me. I'm not sure what they're going for, but I'm not quite sold. You know, that's something that they can work on, but it's like, if you stop to try to make sense of this show, you're just going to never get there. It's just never going to happen. You have to kind of watch this show and just enjoy it for what it is, because it's putting itself right there on its sleeve. You know, it's basically telling you, look, we know we're completely utterly ridiculous.
When Ichabod said that he was there when Franklin was using the kite with the key, I slapped my hand in my face. I was like, oh, face bombed myself, because I was like, oh, good gosh, what the heck? Who doesn't he know? Where hasn't he been? Good.
Yes, but that's part of the whole thing.
You said, you just have to take it in.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, exactly.
No, yeah, no, it was great how they were just completely embracing all of that stuff people were saying last season about, you know, oh no, did he know absolutely everybody in the Revolutionary War period? It's like, yes, he did.
Unbelievable example.
Yeah, no,
but I didn't need Franklin naked, okay? I could have skipped that.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is the air bath was actually historically accurate, but one thing that amused me about that is because I remember reading in places, you know, people saying, it's like, you know, wait a minute, you know, that whole key experiment, it has nothing to do with electricity. And so for them to take that premise and then just warp it into this, you know, oh no, he didn't care about electricity. He's just trying to destroy this demonic key.
But of course, come on, you don't remember that from history? But all right, well, what else is there to really say? I think that they did a smart thing. They went against convention quite a bit. And, yeah, I'm looking forward to where it goes from here.
Yeah, definitely.
I just want to go for a ride.
Yes.
All right, let's see then. Gary, I believe you're up next.
Who, me? Yeah, okay, I'm up. Let's go knock on our favorite blue box and see what the doctor's been up to.
All right, and here's the promo.
This is the Bank of Carol Black Sauce.
Picture the thing you want most in the universe. Decide how badly you want it.
We're actually going to do it. Rob the bank.
If we don't, we die.
We must locate them.
What is that?
I don't know.
Hate not knowing.
Are you hungry, boy?
The bank is now open.
All right, and Gary, if you could you remind us why we're here again? Just, it seems to have slipped my mind.
I'm not quite sure, but I just want to let you know that we know why we are here and we need to do this. We need to have this review on this episode. We're talking about Doctor Who, Season 8, Episode 5, Time Heist. The Doctor attempts to break into the most dangerous bank in the entire cosmos. And that's all the review I have.
Okay. Well, let's see then. That having been said, what would you give this episode?
I would give it a 6.5.
6.5. All right. And Edmund, how about you?
On the strength of my great adoration of Keeley Hawes, I will give it a 7.
All right. And going over to VogNetwork.com just to confirm. I know you guys are thinking, boy, one's a 7, the other's a 6.5. Surely I had to give it something better. Nope, I came in at 7. So, yes, this is very much of an average episode.
A 7, John. What made you give it a 7? You love Doctor Who.
Well, the fact of the matter is that, well, it just felt completely disorganized, as if it wasn't even...
Yeah.
It felt like, all right, this episode had two writers. And the first writer, of course, is our friend Steve Moffat. However, I don't think he's the one who started it. I have a feeling that it was started by the other author, Stephen Thompson, who is perhaps better known for writing the one episode of Sherlock that everyone feels is a letdown, second episode of the first series. And he also wrote the episodes of Doctor Who, Curse of the Black Spot, which is the infamous pirate episode, and Journey to the Center of the TARDIS, which is forgettable to the point of absurdity. So I would not be surprised at all if this started off as Stephen Thompson kind of trying to take his first stab at it and Stephen Moffat trying to come in and make more sense of what was going on, because it just did not feel like it came together as a self-contained episode that really didn't have anything to do with anything else. It just kind of was there. It was blatantly obvious to me that the Doctor was the one that was behind the whole thing. You had the typical thing where the guest characters were there for a very specific purpose, and once that they fulfilled that, they were kind of out of the picture. And, yeah, it just... I think I've kind of put my... kind of gotten my head around why I felt this was fairly average, but how about you, Edmund?
Yeah, well, for me, I mean, this is something that I actually referenced at the beginning of our last episode, but things, as ever with Doctor Who, got a little timey-wimey. But the biggest issue for me was here they were trying to pull off a heist drama, and what the episode was really doing was just reminding me that hustle and leverage have spent a good part of the last decade at their best doing this much better. And it certainly didn't help that, as you say, it was glaringly obvious that the architect was the Doctor, and even the things that have been set up to help them just seem to be completely working against this idea of this being the most difficult bank to break into in the universe. And as I said, even though, you know, I think my rating might have been a bit lower if Keeley Hawes hadn't been in it, but she also felt criminally underused. It's sort of a concept that could have been more interesting. Her being both, you know, her clones of herself being both the director and the managing director, or whatever you want to call it. I'm forgetting her specific character name as running the bank. All of the concepts just felt like stuff that it was too easy to figure out. And with when you're trying to pull off this sort of concept, you need to have some fun twisty twist that take you off guard. And none of this really did. And in a way, I mean, even the final. Even though the final resolution that this wasn't get some fabulous treasure, but just to reunite this couple, which is a very Doctor Who-ish sort of thing to do, just wound up leaving me shaking my head and wondering, okay, so why did we just go through all of this?
Yeah, exactly. Like, just give me some kind of, I don't know, purpose behind it all.
Yeah, I mean, when they do these derivative episodes, and that's what I'll call it, you know, usually there's some unique Who twist to it. And while Edmund was saying there was, I really did feel that it was a strong enough flavor of Doctor Who thrown back into this episode to make it generic episode, whatever, from any type of show.
Oh yeah, but I was saying it was the sort of twist that that Doctor Who has pulled off in the past, but it just wasn't doing it this time.
Yeah, and that's why I feel like they almost did what they could to try to spruce it up. But yeah, it just didn't work for me.
Not to mention the demotion of Clara in this episode. You know, we were talking about how she's starting to come into her own a little bit more. That all got thrown out the window for this episode.
Well, we had two people that came in as temporary members of, you know, this heist team that got more development and actual things to do in this episode than the companion did.
Yeah.
I mean, what did Clara do? Really? Not much. From what I can tell.
For the other characters. But that was...
And then there was that whole thing with, like, the guy Sai getting kind of interested in her and doing things, at least in my mind, that didn't make a whole lot of sense for someone who just met Clara. I mean, yeah, I will say that I do like this penchant of them writing scenes of Clara coming from a date to go on adventures, because then she's, you know, extremely well-dressed and rather very attractive to look at. But give the character something to do. Don't just make her, you know, run around. I mean, it was disappointing. But I gave it a 7 because there were still some highlights in terms of the Doctor's characterization. I do feel like at this point Capaldi is really taking ownership of the character, and I'm feeling much more comfortable with the way that he's approaching things. And
I'm glad you are, because I am.
Oh, really?
I am not enjoying this Doctor. You know, when I was a kid, you know, I was introduced with Tom Baker, but then I fell off the wagon until Tennant came around, and then, you know, I've caught up on everything back to him, even Eccleston, and now that we're in this somewhat of a new era with an older, stodgier Doctor, I'm having a hard time with it. I realize that that the younger Doctors we've had are almost somewhat atypical for the franchise, but I've gotten used to someone who wasn't quite so grumbly, or at least oddity maybe is the word I'm looking for. And I'm still, I'm not that I've given up, but I'm having a harder time warming up to this rejuvenation than I have others.
Well, we've dominated this conversation, but at any rate, Edmund, I mean, at this point, what do you think of Capaldi and the direction that they're going with his version of the Doctor?
Well, I'm very much enjoying what Capaldi's doing, and I do feel like he's sort of gotten past those sort of teething pains that I think most Doctors, or at least these modern Doctors, have had at the beginning. And I was always very much on board with having what we expected to be sort of an older, more crotchety Doctor, and so yeah, I'm enjoying where he's gotten to so far.
Mm. Yeah, I'm also thinking in terms of, we're recording this at a peculiar time, because normally we don't see the next episode before we talk about it necessarily.
Yes.
But in this case, I feel like some of the things that we complained about in this episode are going to be covered, or at least addressed, in the next one. And so this, looking back on it, I'm even more critical than I was when I wrote up my review for VogNetwork.com. But we'll see. We'll see what maybe your reaction is, Gary, to the next episode.
I have high hopes. It's just, as I said, this has been a rough regeneration for me.
Oh, understandable. All right. Well, that having been said, Gary, is there anything else on the list here that you are up to date on?
I wish I was, sir. There's so much on my DVR that's starting to fill up as the seasons are coming in. Not at the moment.
Okay. Well, yep. Then we will defer on Manhattan until you are up to speed.
Oh, thanks, because that's near the top of my list to see, because I do love it so.
Yes.
All right. In which case, Edmund and I will finish this one out.
All right, guys. Have a great night. We'll catch you in the next episode.
Okay.
Absolutely. Take care, Gary.
All right, because I just know that there's no way that we're going to be able to go much further without addressing a certain premiere.
Yes, indeed. Saving the best for last.
That's right. And, well, here's Person of Interest.
I think an AI slipped into the world unannounced, then set out to strangle its rivals in the crib.
There's a larger power in play now, one that we are ill-equipped to face.
Samaritan.
Please be quiet.
Don't you understand? They're always watching.
Now's not the time to be precious, Harold. You don't get to sit this one out, because this is war.
What, my dear Samaritan, are your commands for us?
All right, and if you could do the recap.
Certainly. This is Person of Interest, Season 4, Episode 1, Panopticon. The fourth season opens with Finch, Reese, Shaw, and Root adapting to the new identities created to protect them from Samaritan. Meanwhile, the machine continues to send out numbers, potentially putting the entire group in danger of detection.
Oh, yes. And what would you give this one?
I will give this a 9.
A 9.
Tuesday was a very good night for premieres.
Yes, it was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And we can only hope that it continues along those lines as we eventually catch up with the Supernatural.
Yes, exactly.
I believe Arrow is still in that night, or is it Flash? Anyway, regardless, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, anyway.
Person of Interest. Let's stick to that. Starting off very strong with a 9 for its premiere. Highlights, if you can keep them to just a few.
Yeah, this is one case where I tend to avoid previews now, or at least the ones that come at the end of shows, but with Person of Interest, of course, you know, I couldn't resist watching the season teasers, the preseason teasers, and certainly with what they were showing of these new identities that the team has been thrust into as they've gone undercover, it really played out just as well as I imagined. Certainly Sean Root at Bloomingdale's. I mean, anybody who has had to endure the perfume samplers on a New York department store floor. I mean, you know, really love the concept of Shaw using that perfume bottle like a can of mace. And certainly just the continuing flirtation between, or at least on Root side, with pushing all of Shaw's buttons, I thought was very nicely done, and the way they're playing on things that they've established over the seasons, with Reese having been impersonating U.S. Marshals for most of the last 3 years, so to have him show up as a police detective, I thought was a very nice touch. And then with Finch, I mean, other than the shock of seeing him with a name that's not bird related, him being shunted off into apparently, I guess it looked like more like a community college land, and being a very, very principled professor, who will not brook any interference with his professorial duties, however appealing. I did particularly like, I mean, given the way things have panned out, that it really is Finch who is the one who is the most reluctant, who's feeling kind of the most wary and the most betrayed, and really feeling like, as he says, you know, no, this is all just about survival now, and going from that sort of master of the universe on top of the world and his machine, and being able to control everything from his library hideout, through a monitor, to being this retiring, literally, But what I was not expecting was the way they spent the first half of the episode setting up all of these new situations that they're in. But then just in the course of this episode, having that number come up, having them forced to try and help this guy. But of course the particularly the moment, the details of this network he's setting up for this crime lord, or wannabe crime lord, I guess would probably be more appropriate. Realizing that, taking an ignored, considered obsolete technology and, using it to set up an undetectable network. And it was like, oh gee, who could use that? And then to have it completely swing by the end of the episode to Finch and Bear being led to we've been going on and on about the Batman analogies for 3 years, but having them be led to what certainly feels like a bat cave, and then that wonderful closing of Reese showing up as Fusco's new partner and already back in the suit. I thought they did a wonderful job of both setting this whole new world that they're having to live in, and at the same time, by the end of the episode, getting them around to what looks like it'll be their new status quo. A really masterful job of pushing things forward and not, recent years, the opening episodes have tended to be sort of more of an extended story, but this is just more of a reboot, but in the best sense of the word, of just getting everything set for the new challenges they're going to have to take on.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me to see how Finch was the one that was the most spooked by all of this. One would expect that after Root had gone to so much trouble to help them survive, that it would be obvious that when she came out of the woodwork to start getting in touch with people again, that it would be a signal that something more was going on. I also thought it was fairly obvious that the machine was not completely gone, just in hiding itself.
Yes.
And so sooner or later, as any resistance must do, you're going to come out of hiding, and you're going to start moving against the oppressor. So, I think that maybe it was just something that Finch had thought was a complete moot point. But at the same time, I think there may even have been people in the audience that didn't quite consider the fact that the machine was just trying to survive,
yeah,
and would eventually come out and start moving. And I'm sure that that's what Finch found, was some kind of underground base of operations that Root had been working on or something to that effect. But we'll see it next week, I would imagine. But
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, well, certainly what was shown, I mean, was, I know from, I've had a certain interest in the architecture and infrastructure of New York, is that it's definitely some sort of a abandoned subway tunnel, because I know those do exist still underneath Lower Manhattan. So I'm very interested to see what exactly they've come up with, because that's one thing I've always appreciated about this show, is the fact that it is New York based and very proudly films in New York and Manhattan and around that whole tri-state area. So it was, I'm hoping we're going to see some really fun old tiles and tunnels and that sort of thing as things go on.
See, what they're going to find down there is a whole bunch of bald mutants with a wrong franchise.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, I think anyone from the area recognized exactly what that was.
Yes. Yeah.
that Finch was walking down into, and the stories, the folklore around what you may or may not find down in those abandoned tunnels is just always something of great mileage, story wise.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a great start. Everybody had their moments to shine in this one.
Yeah.
And I'm just looking forward to seeing how they continue this bid for survival.
Absolutely. No, and I just also just want to give a tip of the hat to the production team, because as good as the machine graphics have been over the past three seasons, I just think they've really outdone themselves with the new creepier Samaritan graphics.
They are creepy.
Yeah. and also it was really sort of reinforcing over this whole thing of, you know, we've been used to the machine with its somewhat more limited scope, but that whole sense of, you know, no, now Samaritan is basically global, and it actually makes it even more believable that, you know, yes, you know, these, you know, those seven servers that are basically protecting them, that is something that could work, because it has so much information now that it's getting flooded with that, you know, yeah, it's going to take quite some time before, you know, somebody starts to realize that, you know, might realize that something's been messed with.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, you get too big for your own good.
Yeah.
So it's definitely going to be interesting to see how it all plays out.
Yeah.
I especially like how the episode started with the rather attractive agent.
Yes.
Of,
oh, yes.
Samaritan.
Yes. Yes. Samaritan's Shaw, as I'm referring,
yes,
to
exactly,
her at the
exactly
moment. Yeah.
All right, well, we are going to go ahead and wrap this one up with the quick hits for the week, and I'm sure that they will be relatively quick, because there's not that many of them.
No.
And there's a couple I needed to catch up on, but there we are. Let's go ahead and start with Legends, Season 1, Episode 6, Gauntlet. Fallout from a shootout finds Martin taking Kyle Dobson into custody. Before long, Dobson's mysterious employers enlist hitmen to retrieve a wounded Dobson, prompting Martin to plan a desperate escape with Dobson back to Los Angeles. All right, and that's the only episode I was able to catch up on. I'm about a week behind, but that's no matter. Edmund, are you caught up on this one?
Yes, I am. I think I would give that one a 7.5.
Okay, and I would give it an 8. I thought that it was a little spare, but I enjoyed the usual survival skills that he was displaying, shall
yeah,
we say.
Yeah, that was what was tempting me into an 8, actually, was the way they handled that whole final standoff. And actually one of those situations where a top agent taking on an entire hit squad actually felt reasonably believable.
All right, and if you could take the next one.
Certainly. This is The Good Wife, another premiere, Season 6, Episode 1, The Line. Season 6 begins with Alicia refusing to run for state's attorney, despite Eli's attempts to persuade her to launch a campaign. Meanwhile, Diane considers joining Floric Agos as a partner, but an internal crisis threatens to destroy the firm. And Henry, over on the website, gave this an 8. So, looks like a decent return for The Good Wife.
That's right. Okay, and the next one on the list is The Lottery. Season 1, Episode 9, Mr. Torino. Vanessa confronts Darius about his plans and surprises him by trying to subvert them. Meanwhile, Allison and Kyle meet the May 2s and learn that they are funded by a powerful sponsor who can help rescue Elvis. And the president learns about Gabriel's deal with Perry and confronts her about her motives.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds far weirder than it actually is, especially the Elvis part. But at any rate, what would you give this one, do you think?
I would give this one a 7.5 as well.
Yeah, that's about where I'm at, which is similar to the previous episode. I still feel like this is not quite an average show, but it's still not hitting it out of the park, even with some of the very clear sci-fi influences on it.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to mention, I mean, the part that really got to me about this one was that whole thing about Gabrielle's deal, which for someone who's been presented as politically savvy and astute as the First Lady has been, how she ever thought that would fly and she could get away with it just made no sense to me whatsoever.
Exactly. It fell flat.
Yeah.
I'll go ahead and take the next one. The Musketeers, Season 1, Episode 9, Knight Takes Queen. Frustrated by his wife's infertility, King Louis makes a foolish statement, suggesting it were best if she were dead. As a result, Richelieu sends Irish gunman Gallagher and his gang to kill her while she is traveling with the Musketeers.
Yeah.
And yeah, boy, what would you give this?
I will give this an 8.
Okay, and I gave it an 8.5. I thought this was a nice bounce back from the inexplicable weakness of the previous episode.
Yes.
And talk about displaying all of the various sides of Peter Capaldi.
Yes.
In this particular episode. I think we should make Gary watch this.
Yeah.
And then watch Doctor Who. You can get a nice compare contrast going.
Absolutely.
And finally, go ahead.
No.
Give you a chance to dig in. Go ahead.
Cat. Yes. My cat decided my mic needed to be in my lap. So anyway, I basically agree. So
okay. Well, there you go. And the last one, please, if you don't mind.
Yes, this is Masters of Sex, Season 2, Episode 11, One for the Money, Two for the Show. A television crew arrives to document Masters and Johnson's work. I will actually give this a 6.5. There was one particular plot twist that happened in this episode that was completely unbelievable to me. They'd been sort of hinting at it, and I was fearful of it for a while, but Libby, Master's wife, and the black activist who she's been who's running the core office, where she's been working, actually do start an affair. Which I have no problem with these characters necessarily getting together, but the way it was built up, there was absolutely no chemistry between the two of them, and it all happened after this very rational man who's in a position of prominence that he needs to protect has just outlined the very reasons why this shouldn't happen, and they managed to generate absolutely no sense of why they would rush into it anyway. So, and that was actually at the end of the episode, and I was spending the entire time while it was happening hoping against hope that it was all going to wind up being her fantasy of what she wanted to happen as she's looking out the window watching him leave. But unfortunately, that's not the way it ended. So that's the main reason for the lower score. But in addition, they are continuing to focus primarily on Masters and Johnson and trying to address his sexual dysfunctions. And at this point, in my mind, it's really starting to hurt the show. And given that we now have three different successful series on Showtime, I'm really starting to wonder if some producer or showrunner is finally going to get sick and tired of it and reveal how much Showtime executives keep pushing them to just focus on these central characters, and keep the relationships going, and to the detriment of the rest of the supporting players, and forward direction of the show, basically, because at this point when we're going into the season finale, and I have my fingers crossed that maybe they can bounce back, but I have not been happy with the direction of this show in the last few episodes.
That's unfortunate. I mean, certainly this was a big show last season,
and
for it to kind of fall apart this year is
And of course, to be more specific, I'm talking about the problems that have beset Homeland and wound up besetting Dexter as well. So
that's right. There's somebody up there that's just trying to ensure that they get fresh content by totally undermining the shows they already have.
Exactly.
That must be it. All right, well, that is it for this week. Yes, I know, another two-episode week, but that's the way that it goes. I can almost guarantee it won't be that way next time.
No.
So, any last thoughts, Edmund?
No, I'm ready for the season to begin in earnest.
That's right.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as Fair Use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time. Watch, watch, read, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.